Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 418A, December the 7th, 1979, side one of the tape. The Iranian crisis is now starting its second month, and we'll have to get used to that in the news. I'm going to run through some of that very quickly and hopefully get to some of the recent murders or deaths that are terribly important that are piling up that I'm not able to cover each week. There were two articles this past week in the newspaper that I think were of primary importance. I have about 60 very important articles on Iran in front of me, but the two that epitomize what are going on are from the New York Times. One is a James Reston report that was in last Sunday's paper. He went to the Soviet Union to sound out the Soviet Union on how they felt. I'm sure that Reston was sent there to see if the Soviets would hint at whether or not they would enter into a war if the United States began to bomb Iran, if the trials started there and we attacked them. Would the Soviets enter into the war, or would they stay out of it like they did when we were in Southeast Asia? So James Reston from the New York Times went over to the Soviet Union to see officials to sound them out. And the officials that he quoted in the article made several important statements that really set the stage for what is going on. And I want to quote those, some of them directly and some to paraphrase. What these people in the Soviet Union told him was that Mr. Brzezinski is their favorite villain, that they think that he's the most detrimental person to world peace. And I believe that's true also. I think Mr. Brzezinski wants a war, that 1985 war against the Soviet Union, and they realized that they almost had a meeting place or a d'entente, a period up till 1974, when matters really took a turn from the worst. In this article, I'll quote directly, they stated in Moscow, rather sadly, even with kind of injured self-pity, that the United States has always regarded the emergence of the Soviet Union in 1917 as an illegitimate child of history and has never fully adjusted to the new facts of a modern world. The core of the problem, officials insist, is that the United States seems unable to realize it can no longer have its own way in the world, as it did in the first years after World War II, but is now vulnerable like other nations and compelled to come to terms with conflicting political, economic, and military forces. The Soviet officials said that America's problem is not the Soviet Union, but with itself. It has not redefined its position in a world of different centers of power, no longer subject to U.S. domination, and must sort out those facts of the 1980s and make the psychological adjustment necessary to meet them. What James Reston is saying, quoting the Soviet officials, is that the United States never accepted the Russian Revolution, that the Tsar and his wife could be kicked out, that the people could organize against the monarchy. We thought of them as an illegitimate child, that during World War II we could overrule and try to take. When we didn't win that war, we armed for World War III, and that we cannot face the facts of modern life, that people can figure things out for themselves and rise up and have a revolution and take care of governments themselves without the United States or Great Britain or Germany interfering. This article says that the latest impediment to d'entente and peace are the U.S. policies towards Europe and China, the proposed deployment of 600 new U.S. missiles in forward positions in Europe, capable of hitting anything up to the Urals, and they said this was an obvious threat to the security of the USSR, and the basis of which they wanted to control is strategic weapons. And they went on to say that we're playing the China card, making alliances with China, which would be intolerable and a threat to the Soviet Union. The decline of the relations in the United States since 1974, the regular trade relations began in 1974, that Mr. Brzezinski wants war, we're aiming towards a war and deteriorating, and that the United States cannot adjust to the new facts of the modern world. I received a letter from one of my favorite listeners and subscribers who made some suggestions or criticisms about my viewpoint of the political scene. And one of the questions or statements he made was, in quotes, "I wish you would tone down hammering the people and the capitalistic system and war won't come from threatening Jimmy Carter's administration. I mentioned last week that Jimmy Carter was looking weak and that by having a wartime power, Mr. Brzezinski and Mr. Kissinger and Chase Manhattan would hold on to their world power and grab, and that if the chips came down that there was a legitimate revolution against the United States and Iran, similar to the one that happened in 1917 in Russia against the Tsar, that we would go to war, that we're not going to adjust to the fact that people can rule by themselves without the United States or Germany or Great Britain interfering. I can't tone down my feelings about the capitalist system because I don't think it can survive. I believe that capitalism keeps stretching to the point known as fascism. And when you have to have secret police and terror and torture camps and arm the world and ignore your health of your citizens, the health of people abroad that you have wiped out or drugged or done mental experiments on, when you have to have police that you mistrust, trained by the Gestapo and the Nazi agents, and kill presidents, civil rights leaders, and continuous political assassinations all over the world. If that's what it takes to keep capitalism going, capitalism is just that fine line to fascism, and that's what we have. I'm not knocking capitalism, I'm knocking fascism, and I believe that this government will not stop until the whole world is fascist, because this is the continuation of World War III or the Thousand-Year Reich. If we had a choice, I would take a capitalism similar to, say, Sweden or Canada. Many people would say that's socialist. But I certainly don't like what the United States is doing, and I don't call it capitalism. I very clearly call it fascism. The answer to the Soviet Union and to James Reston that was published in last week's papers, this weekend, Sunday, came in the New York Times by Henrik Smith on Wednesday of this week. And I think this article is the most clear, that spells out the position of Congress and the Pentagon at this time and their intentions, and again, I call this fascism. It's an article called Turning Point for U.S. Policy, and what it's really saying is no more nice guys. We're going to send the troops in wherever we want, and I'm going to read a few direct quotations from that article in case you don't take the New York Times. The article said, "The Iranian crisis has brought an important shift of attitudes in Washington. The United States will project its power to the third world. It will develop greater military capability for protecting its interests." Now, what it's saying there is that the interest of the multinational is what comes first. They're not going to pay any attention to the slaves anymore, and no more nice guy. The corporations have taken the weapons and the spy systems, and the masses are not about to destroy them. The article says, in quotes, "The liberals and conservatives alike are speaking of their political and psychological watershed being more important than the 50 hostages. The men that are hostages in Iran are not as important as what is going on and the view that we're giving the world." In quotes, "This is the end of the Vietnam syndrome," according to George Ball, who's a policymaker with the Trilateralists and the Bilderbergers. "No more sob sisters or defeat." He said, in quotes, "We have a sense of guilt complex over Vietnam. We must move away from the post-Vietnam reticence." Now, just getting off from that direct quote, "We left the country in shambles, totally bankrupt, chemicals in the water, people diseased, families broken up, so many deaths over there. We walk away," and George Ball says, "we have to walk away from Vietnam and not have a guilt complex." Then the article quotes Gary Hart of Colorado. They go on to say that these are the liberals in Congress that they're quoting, Senator Church and Gary Hart and so forth. Hart said, "It's not just Iran. We've been through a period of shocks over the past 5 years because of the fall of Saigon and the formation of OPEC and the oil embargo. Our military supremacy seems to have ended, and there's increased nationalism abroad and less fear of the United States because others are more potent than us." He goes on and illustrates that we are not supreme all over the world anymore. "Since Vietnam," the article says, "the pendulum has swung too far in the opposite direction of national self-doubt and total non-intervention in the third world." I don't know what they mean. I think the only country we lost was Nicaragua. The rest of all of South America is fascist. But the article says, "the Iranian crisis forged a consensus that we have to redress that balance."
the visual image, and this is what really hurts them, the visual image of American humiliation in Iran is important. They have stirred a public reaction and an acute sense of long-term American vulnerability. That community must now expand its military capabilities and treat the Middle East as a sphere of influence where Washington must be prepared to use its power. It is our flag that is being desecrated. It's our people who are blindfolded. The apologies are now over. The trend toward increased defense spending was starting, this article says, before the Iranian crisis, but then Senator Sam Nunn from Georgia said, we're going to fight for more weapons. I read just last Sunday's paper that if Ted Kennedy gets the nomination, he's considering Mr. Nunn as a vice president, and this is a man that's been pushing for more and more weapons continuously in Congress. The article says, before the Iranian crisis, they argued to increase defense spending based on Soviet competition, but now the defense spending is to protect the oil supplies for the United States of America. The Carter administration wants a long-range program to develop rapid deployment forces to respond to upheavals in the Third World, particularly the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean. Of course, that would start with Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Ethiopia. The White House earmarked $300 million for long-range cargo planes, ships for deployment, and billions of dollars will be needed in the next decade. And Frank Church said, we are prepared in principle to endorse military intervention even in friendly countries if Western oil interests are threatened. Senator Church said, the highly volatile and unpredictable politics of the Middle East, the wave of hysteria in the Islamic world, the explosive possibilities of countries like Saudi Arabia and Iraq tell us we have to be prepared to take action to protect our vital interests. The vital interests of the United States, Western Europe, and Japan, those are the trilateral areas, and must take care of the Saudi Arabian oil fields. This was in the New York Times, as if Saudi Arabia is a third world country. They're asking Japan to take care of, with us, with the Saudi Arabian oil fields. It would necessitate military action if our interests were threatened. If that required the organization of strike forces, there would be strong support on Capitol Hill. The liberal Democrats, it goes on, are advocating Navy buildups, permanent aircraft carriers close to the Indian Ocean, and they're prodding Japan, that was formerly an Axis country fighting us during World War II, to take a more active role in the Pacific to protect sea lanes. Senator Charles Mathias of Maryland urged the rebuilding of the intelligence capabilities, that's the CIA and the DIA, national security agencies, of course. And then the article closes by saying it is important to shed any qualms about American power. No longer are the public and Congress going to be saying that a military role for the United States outside of Europe is wrong, and we're going to head and use our military if we want. Now, when Saudi Arabia reads that and New York Times article and doesn't respond to that, I'll be very surprised. But the implications here are that we will ask Germany and Japan, Europe and Japan, to help us keep a permanent fleet there. And any time we want to take that oil, we will. Now, I said a long time ago that this story about the Saudi Arabians pulling money out of the American banks and bankrupting, as such as described in that book, The Crash of 79, wouldn't happen because we'd confiscate their money and just go in and take their oil. And this is actually, I'm very surprised, almost a declaration of war to Saudi Arabia, that if we want the oil, we're going to take it. No more nice guys. We need oil. We've moved from Asia. Forget the Asian conflict. Forget all the Saab sisters talk of napalm or Agent Orange or a war, or the anti-war protests, I'm sure. I don't listen to these people, the Jane Fondas and the Saab sisters. We're going in where we need it and take what we need. And this is the conflict of the policy written down in the New York Times of the American Congress and their attitude and the War Department's attitude as compared to what the Soviet Union says, that the United States simply cannot grow up and be mature enough to accept the fact that people do have revolutions, that they do change, and that there's changes all over the world, that we have to be sob sisters, we want to control things, and we don't have it our way, we rush in. The Soviet Union is saying, that's our problem, the way we run in. And then 3 days later comes an article that says, we intend to send the fleet, to send the money, so that our whole economy in this country is going to be geared towards making war in the Middle East on the excuse that we'll need to protect the oil. It's ours if we want it. And we'll extend our fleet, our arms, everything. If it's there and we want it and the multinationals want it, we'll take it. The empires of Great Britain were temporarily broken up during World War II. The United States stepped in along with British intelligence and the French and Germans. They've earmarked the globe, they've marked it off, and they're going to take it no matter the price. Before I get to other matters, I do want to summarize once more my analysis of the Iranian problem so far, and I have discussed it on tape 415 and 417. If you don't have those, you can get the earlier ones as the situation is building up. First of all, I don't agree with the newscasters, the people that are writing to me that Khomeini is crazy. I don't believe he's crazy. I believe that he was put into power as a ploy to get our troops over in the Middle East, to get a foothold against the Soviet Union, to be assured that if we make a war in 1985 that we have all the oil we need by having our troops very well stationed through the whole Middle East, that it would supply us with that oil we would need to make war against the Soviet Union. I think that Khomeini got into power, and he has pushed out certain people that helped put him into power, and he's a genius. I don't think people get to where they are just being silly or crazy. Khomeini's dealing with a generation that is 26 years old now since the Shah was put into power. His father was kicked out of there. He's playing around with the Nazis. The Shah came into power through the Central Intelligence Agency. And there are enough people in Iran that are illiterate, that don't have hot and cold water, that don't like the secret police, that don't like to be shot down in the streets, that see industrialization and want a part of it. I don't think it's so much that they're turning their back entirely on modernization or industrialization, but if it means that it's only the advantage of the very wealthy and the rest remain slaves, then they'd rather not have any of it. This is what we're seeing in other countries where we have progress and industrialization, such as in Korea and the Philippines, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and so forth, down in Brazil or Argentina. Progress, social progress, and jet-set life is very fine for a handful, but as long as the others live in the Stone Age and have no benefits of it, then they'd rather just have everyone stay where they are or work themselves up equally. So that what we're seeing here is a group of people who are being taken through the Shah's palace. They're being shown his gold toilets and gold fixtures and the jewels and the silver, and they realize what their homes are like, and Khomeini has fired their imagination. He is the first person that I know of to speak up to the United States and the CIA, and he's a symbol. It's a symbolism that the people in Washington are going crazy about. They don't want a trial. They don't want any information out, and he threatened a large institution like the Chase Manhattan Bank by wanting the money of the Shah taken back to his country. I don't know anybody who's challenged David Rockefeller and the New York bankers and claimed that a head of state who left stole the money away from them. I also think the Mideast crisis is manipulated in a very complex way with a cast of characters that are fantastic, their background and their training, and maybe we'll go into those another time. But the United States is sabotaged from the inside. I think that there are forces disrupting and disuniting us. There are people turning us against each other and the various candidates. I feel that we're being isolated from the real world the way it should be, and that we're inadequately prepared for any kind of confrontation. The next one we get into, we'll lose, and that our advisors are not really helping us to be strong. Kissinger and Brzezinski are the ringleaders in breaking this country's back and putting us back in the Stone Age. And Khomeini is aware of the people in Washington and of the forces, and after they put him in, he fired the imagination of the people in Iran in a way that the puppet masters didn't expect him to do. And, of course, the question that follows is, what happens next? If the Chase Manhattan is threatened with money being withdrawn, if Kissinger or Brzezinski may be out of power, if Jimmy Carter lost the elections, would we go to war? I brought that up before, and I believe that it's an excuse, you know, the trial that will take place will be the excuse for us to bomb, and even if the hostages are all killed and a few others are killed, it will not matter to Jimmy Carter and the others. It will be a time where Carter will come out strong, looking like a leader, and these people that die will be martyred, and there'll just be 50 other people that died. In the course of time, they won't be remembered so much as the fact that the threat was over and the talk of the blackmail, the talk of the trial. I don't think the people in power really give a damn about the hostages. I don't think they want to do anything but save their own banks and save their own face. And as I said before last week, Jimmy Carter was put in by David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger and Brzezinski. So I don't think he's going to back down, and I don't think he's going to let them be exposed or let them have the chance of a few ballots, putting them out, a few votes. I think that he's going to go on in there as the admiral and handle this crisis by moving into the Middle East. That doesn't mean we'll win. It doesn't mean it's smart. But I don't think the people running this country are smart, and I think they're always the last people to catch on to what's happening anyway. I have a pile of articles on Iran here that are interesting, and I'm sure all of you are following this pretty closely. The U.S. embassies were stormed in Manila, Bangkok, and Kuwait this week. Anwar Sadat invited the Shah to Egypt. Don't you think it's strange that there isn't any country that really wants him now? He may be at Paraguay with Somoza and Mengele's down there. It's really weird that there isn't a country in the world that wants this person. There's a good article in the LA Times last week, Shah's Path to Power Retraced. It goes into the background after World War II and his links with the CIA and their torture and murder and the cultural conflicts and so forth, the gunning down of people, how many of them and how much money was taken. Another article, the insecurity of Saudi Arabia, the oil supply hinges on our reaction to the Iranian crisis. And this goes into Saudi Arabia is insecure about dealing with us. Another article, the United States reassures Saudis on their bank assets. They're afraid that the money may be taken from them if they deposit in this country. The charges that the men in the embassy are CIA. I'm sure you all know about those charges. Another NBC News last week, December the 3rd, they were saying on television when he went to Texas, the Shah has fewer options than most people realize. And, of course, Jimmy Carter's mother suggested that they buy a hitman for $1 million to kill Khomeini. I think that's disgusting. And another article, how the Middle East crisis boosts Carter's campaign for president. Evans and Novak, the man who toppled the Shah, and this is about Robert Huser, Haig's deputy, and how the Shah was slipped out of office and the conflict in the Pentagon. Another article, The Bitter Shah by Jack Anderson, on the way Jimmy Carter's team had the Shah eased out and didn't supply the troops to back him up. UPI story, the Soviets see U.S. military buildup. The crisis is a pretext. And this goes on to say that we wanted our military in the Indian Ocean, so we created this crisis to impose on other people in the Middle East our troops, and our goal was to get armed interference and hold on to the oil in the Middle East. The Shah moved out to Texas, and the first person to see him from Texas was Henry Gonzalez. He's the member from the House of Representatives that received the clothing of John Connally after Kennedy's assassination and took it to his apartment and then sent out to be dry cleaned so that the FBI was called to testify on whether they were entry or exit bullets in John Connally, which would make a difference on where the assassin was located. And they had testified, the FBI, that they had been dry cleaned so they no longer could be used as exhibits for a homicide for the President of the United States. The man who took them in a paper bag from Texas to Washington, D.C. and had them sent the dry cleaner was Henry Gonzalez. So it's perfectly reasonable that that same kind of CIA mentality would be the first Texan to interview the Shah when he was taken to his state. There also was an article in the paper about mind control and brainwashing of the hostages, and it quotes Dr. Jolly West, the CIA military psychiatrist, who gave an opinion on the mental state of the hostages, Jolly West was, of course, the psychiatrist, one of them that saw Jack Ruby, and they tried to pass Ruby's case off as, when he killed Lee Harvey Oswald, as not being a conspiracy to silence Lee Harvey Oswald, but Ruby had a one-minute epilepsy. Then Jolly West came to California to work with Ronald Reagan and UCLA and the CIA to do experimentations on Indians and blacks and minority and third world people and their brains, using UCLA as a base for their experimentation. They come out now and say he's a military man and a CIA man. He always was, whether it's from the time he saw Jack Ruby or Patty Hearst or talked about hostages. It's interesting how when you study the political assassinations and then other events come out, you have the same cast of characters always running through them. Another article this week, the U.S. accused of colonialism. This was in Mexico City, 1,000 nationals meeting representing 100 nations, and they accused the United States of being involved in colonialism. An article, the limitation on oil, Iran asks OPEC to stop, hold up the oil of these major countries from the United States. They appealed to Algeria, Saudi Arabia, Ecuador, Gabon, Indonesia, Libya, Nigeria, Qatar, United Arab Emirates. Israel came through with flying colors, just like I always said they would. I have said many times personally and on tapes or with people, radio programs, that the whole purpose of allowing Israel to exist as a country was to use it as a military base when the United States wanted to secure its oil in the Middle East. Sure enough, this week, Israel speaks up and said, if you want to use Israel as a launching pad for fighting Iran, you can. You can use us, in quotes, for bases. Former Israeli Defense Minister Shimon Peres. I've never supported the Israeli movement or the Zionist cause because I knew it would be a launching pad in World War III, and then, in return, the Arabs would retaliate by bombing Israel off the map. And by the time they say, well, we'll have peace in the Middle East and we'll go back to producing oil, there will be no more Israel. This week they had to open their mouth and offer that country as a launching pad for a war against Iran. There's another article, an alleged interview with the Shah that he's denying. It was in a German newspaper. This article gets in a few digs against John Kennedy and says the world is heading for an inevitable downfall. I thought that was interesting. He praised Stalin, de Gaulle, and Roosevelt and said that they'd turn over in their graves if they saw what came after them. But he didn't mention Eisenhower and Truman and John Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles and Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, the people that were giving him accolades while he was in power. Another article, the United Nations wants to prove the Shah's money. They're willing to go into the finances of the Shah. I don't think that the Rockefeller, Kissinger, Chase Manhattan would allow that. That's why I think that they're on the brink of a war, and I don't think they're going to even consider his money, because the money is linked to organized crime and dope, narcotics, and secret bank accounts all over the world, and they're certainly not going to get into that. Another article, Libya gets into the act. The U.S. Embassy in Libya is sacked. The United States wouldn't accept their apologies, and they want to break off with Libya. Two men from the service were killed in Pakistan, and the United States isn't severing relationships with Pakistan. But Libya, as I said before, is one of the countries they want to attack, and so they're not accepting those apologies as an excuse to stay angry. I think on the other side of the tape, I'm going into some recent deaths and leave the Iranian headlines for you to read in your daily newspapers. There's so much of it that I could just do hours and hours, but I think you get the gist of the conflicts and the various elements coming to a head, and I'll do more on it next week or 2 weeks from now, but I think I'll put it away and let you soak up some of the other material, because we can get back to the Iranian question over and over again in the weeks to come. I don't think the team of David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, Brzezinski, and Jimmy Carter will be embarrassed or exposed or humiliated any further, and I wouldn't put it past them to go right into a confrontation if they had to save their reputation and their money. That's how little I think about these people.